So we are going to be starting the book of Exodus in chapter 1 now, after having gone through the introduction earlier this afternoon. Exodus chapter 1. The first verse that we're going to come to is an important bridge between the book of Exodus and Genesis. So we could say it's a bridge between Genesis and Exodus, verse number 1. Exodus 1:1. Now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with him. The reason why I say this is a bridge between Genesis and Exodus is because this is almost equal, verse number 1, to the verse in Exodus chapter 46, verse number 8, where it says, Now these are the names of the children of Israel, Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt. So that verse in Genesis chapter 46 is almost identical to verse number 1 of Exodus and the way it starts. And it bridges Genesis and Exodus together. Now something that I want to point out to you that I mentioned in the introduction is that, okay, well first of all, let me get to this particular frame here. Remember I said in the introduction that Exodus was the Greek name of the book. The Hebrew name for the book comes from the first words of the text, and these are the names of. Now, you'd have to understand Hebrew to really get the meaning of this. So, Exodus is from the Greek, means exit or departure. The Hebrew name is, and these are the names of. That's the Hebrew name for the book of Exodus. Remember now that I said, okay, I'm missing something here. Okay, we'll continue on. Verses 2 through 5. The sons of Israel are listed here in verses 2 through 5, but not in order by their age, but by the mothers of the sons. So we have Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. Now remember that I pointed out from the introduction that this word now, this conjunction and now, is the same as and. So again, that's connecting those 300 years between Genesis and Exodus, connecting events together. Now equals and connects events. Okay, so we have the listing of the children of Israel, or the forefathers of the children of Israel who came into Egypt. Expositors points this out. It says, verses 1 through 7 are a virtual commentary on the ancient promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that their seed would be as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands of the sea. Going back to Genesis chapter 15 and Genesis chapter 22. So, despite the fact that the Hyksos invaded Egypt, they left them alone. They continued to multiply and become like the stars of heaven and the sands of the sea. The Egyptians expelled the Hyksos and put the Israelites into slavery, and they still continue to multiply and grow like the stars of heaven and the sands of the sea. No matter what events took place in history, God's promise that they would grow to be a mighty nation came to fulfillment. And that's what verses 1 through 7 is showing us. God's promises fulfilled. Let's come to verse number 6 now. And Joseph died, and his brothers, and all that generation. So that happened in the time of Genesis. Joseph died, is explained in chapter 50. But then we have verse number 7. There's a 300-year gap between verses 6 and 7, which I explained earlier. Now I want to point out that I've got the New King James verses for you here on the screen today. But I've also inserted from the Old King James where it has the and conjunction beginning the verse. And any of you that are reading in the Old King James will see this, that this verse begins with and. connecting those verses together, but with many years separating them. That's pointed out better in the Old King James than the New King James. See, the New King James, of course, gives us modern language. It gets rid of the these and the thous, and it puts the scriptures into perspective of modern language. So in chapter 1, the New King James translators got rid of all those many of the ands, which connects these events together. Okay, 300-year gap again between verses 6 and 7. That's when the Hyksos dominated Egypt. And it was in between this time of the death of Joseph and the children of Israel increasing mightily to the birth of Moses. Then we come to verse number 8. And there rose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And as I showed you in the previous Bible study, his name is Amosis. He's the new king that doesn't want to see any people from the land of Canaan anymore, and he puts the Egyptians into slavery. This new king, according to the Companion Bible, means a fresh dynasty in the sense of being quite different from what preceded. In other words, the Hyksos that were ruling northern Egypt were Canaanites. Now we have a new king, a new dynasty, who's pure blood Egyptian ruling Egypt. A quote from Merrill, he says, Dynasty 18 was founded by Amosis. He's this new king in verse number 8, the expeller of the Hyksos. It may be he who is described in verse 8 as the new king who did not know Joseph. And he rules for 24 years according to the chronology. Merrill goes on to say, he, Amosis, this new king described in verse number 8, had, after all, just defeated the Hyksos, a people ethnically akin to the Hebrews, and might be concerned that the populous and rapidly multiplying Hebrews could become a threat to his newly established authority. Again, that's a lot of words, and it's saying that he's finally conquered northern Egypt, and he's looking at this multitude of Israelites. They're from Canaan just like the Hyksos. What am I going to do with them? Got to do something. They're a threat. And if they combine, there's thousands and thousands of Israelites. If they combine with the Hyksos, that'd make a mighty army against Egypt. So it's either he, or most likely both of these kings of Egypt, Amosis and Amenhotep I, who were responsible for putting the children of Israel into their great slavery, which is described as we go on through verses 9 through 14. The Egyptians putting Israelites into slavery was according to God's promise to Abraham, which we read earlier, Genesis chapter 15. God said, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, will serve them, and they will afflict them during that time," and it says 400 years. "Also, the nation that they serve, I will judge, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions." So God promised to Abraham that this would happen, that they'd go into slavery. Verse number 9. And, of course, again, we've got events connecting together again. Probably years separated as they're building cities, etc. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we." Verse 10, "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them." And how is he going to deal shrewdly with them? Put them into absolute slavery. "Lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war," now we get to the crux of Pharaoh's thinking, "that they also join our enemies, fight against us, and so go up out of the land." Now again, that's why what we had in the first study is so important to understand the Hyksos domination of Egypt. Fits in with this verse in Pharaoh's thinking. We've got thousands and thousands of these Israelites. They're mightier than we. What happens if they join the Hyksos again, which aren't named here? That's who their enemies were. and fight against us, and then they all leave. That's what Pharaoh was worried about. Here's a quote from The Bible as History by Ian Wilson. He's going to describe the first project that the Israelites are going to be doing in their work. He says this: undeniably, immediately after defeating the Hyksos, Canaanites, Amos, the 18th dynasty's founder, built a palace as if for his own occupation at Avaris. And Avaris was a little more than a stone's throw from where Jacob's descendants with their herds would have been based at their Goshen. So now this is a quote from a book which is quoting archaeological sources. We're going to read that they build supply cities. And we already talked about that previously. Here, it's known that the Israelites were building a palace for Pharaoh in the Delta region, very close to where they were living. Okay, continuing on, Ian Wilson says this: equally clear, Amos was minded to make his edifice as impregnable as possible from any Canaanite attempt to recapture it. So he built his palace as a fort to guard against the Hyksos maybe coming back against them. So he put in hand the building of an enormous platform. Then we learn, unsurprisingly, that the platform was made of mud brick, the standard building material in the Nile Delta. So this is something that's not described in Exodus chapter 1. The supply cities are the defense cities. But from archaeological sources, we see that this King Amos built a palace, a fort, and it was surprisingly made out of mud brick, which is what the Israelites were having to use in the slave projects. One more quote: there is good reason, therefore, for believing that Amos rounded up all the Asiatic, that means Eastern, Nile Delta residents, including Jacob's descendants, who had been unable to make a quick escape with the Canaanite warlords. He forced them into work necessary to make Avaris, the future Ramesses, an Egyptian capital and garrison city, after its fall as a Canaanite Hyksos one. So again, he's just wrapping it all up, that they had to build cities, they had to build a palace for Pharaoh, which was a fort, and that they used mud bricks in the process, garrison cities, and we find this from archaeological finds, and it fits in with Exodus chapter 1. Okay, here's a map of Egypt, verse number 11. And I brought this out previously in the previous study. Therefore they set taskmasters over them. That's how they would deal shrewdly with them. The taskmasters with the whips and the bars and the rods to put them down. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses. And again, cities don't get built overnight. Many, many years the Israelites were working on these cities. Okay, let's take a look at this map now. Here's one of the cities, Ramesses, and the other one is Pithom, which is listed. Notice that here's the tributary system, the delta region of northern Egypt, which is called Lower Egypt. All those tributaries from the Nile. This is the land of Goshen, the breadbasket of Egypt, where Israel was located. Those two cities are on the very eastern part of the Delta region, that breadbasket, to guard against the Hyksos coming back and fighting against them. And the Pharaoh and his court knew what they were doing in building these cities and palaces. Verse number 12, but the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. That verse is another clue that tells us that there was many years involved here. Notice it says that they multiplied and grew. That implies multiple generations. It wasn't just that, you know, boom, there was all these Israelites at one time. It takes years for generations to multiply and grow. And it was during this time, these times of these pharaohs. And notice it says in the last part of verse number 12, they were in dread of the children of Israel. Why were they in dread? They didn't want them to align with the Hyksos again and have them fight against them. That's why they put the, as we would say, the pedal to the metal with the taskmasters against the Israelites in making them work. Then we come to verse number 13. The New King James says, so, the Old King James, and, again, connecting events together, probably years involved here, and the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. Okay? If you just read over that, you just think, well, that's just, you know, maybe possibly a short part of time. Building cities, they're serving with rigor, which takes a lot of time. I got a couple pictures for you. Mud bricks being set out. Verse number 14. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. And their service with which they made them serve was with rigor. That word rigor, which is repeated twice now, means crushingly. They tried to crush the spirit of the Israelites and diminish their numbers by this. That was the hope of the Pharaoh of Egypt, that by crushingly putting them into slavery, they would diminish in numbers and thus not be able to war against them. Okay, here's another picture again of work in the mud bricks in Egypt. Then we come to verse number 15, and it says, then the king of Egypt, and again from the old King James, connecting events, then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shipra, and the name of the other Puah. You read over this real quick and not even realize, but a king of Egypt is being emphasized here in verse number 15, because this was another key king that came along during this time period. This is where we put in Thutmose the First, from 1526 to 1512. He rules for 14 years according to the chronology. So the first two pharaohs had come along that didn't know Joseph are for 44 years putting the Egyptians to work with rigor, building the supply cities, the palace for Pharaoh. Now this king of Egypt comes along, Thutmose the First. And he said in verse 16, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birthstools, if it's a son, then you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, then he shall live. This particular pharaoh developed a new policy with the Israelites. Okay, we can't diminish their numbers by crushing them. Let's kill the male children. That's his new policy as he began to reign. Bible Knowledge Commentary adds this. Most likely, because of the vast number of Israelites, these two women, talking about the midwife Hebrew women, were the chief administrators of an organization of midwives. The king's instructions were explicit. Male babies were to be killed. So, remember, and I emphasized this in the first study, Pharaoh's word was law. When it was decreed, it had to be done. He tells these midwives, kill the Hebrew male children. And he was expecting it to be carried out. Companion Bible adds something interesting here. It says, this was another assault of Satan to destroy the male children and so prevent the seed of the woman from coming into the world. I think that's an interesting perspective of what was going on here. Sometimes people ask the question from verse 16, what does it mean, the birthstools? Well, the Companion Bible says it was probably the stone bath in which the children were bathed. So the stone bath where they were bathed, that's when they were instructed, the midwives, to kill the male children of the Hebrews. But even though Pharaoh's words was law, he was expecting it to be taken care of, we see in verse 17, The midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. There's a great lesson in verse 17, and I'm going to stop for a moment. Pharaoh's word was law. He was the mighty king of Egypt. He expected what he said to be done. These Hebrew midwives didn't do what he said. And we're going to see God is going to bless them for it. That's a lesson for all of us. We have governments that rule over us. They make laws. Sometimes it's against God's word. Who are we going to follow? The government, or are we going to follow God? Good lesson here from this particular verse as we continue on with this story. Verse number 18. So the king of Egypt, and if you read in the old King James, there's an and here as well, connecting events together. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" They could have been put to death for this. Verse 19. And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them." So what these midwives were saying is they were already born before we even got to them, and we couldn't stop it. Bible Knowledge Commentary says, "These midwives answered that the Hebrew midwives delivered so quickly, the Hebrew wives delivered so quickly that before the midwives could arrive, the babies were already delivered." That was their answer to Pharaoh. So we see they feared God more than they did Pharaoh. See what God does here now in verse number 20. "Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty." Better to obey God than the Pharaoh. Verse 21. "And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them." Okay, this word households, according to the Companion Bible, is better translated family. So God blessed them, in other words, for obedience to him instead of Pharaoh. The New Bible Commentary adds this. It says, "When they disobeyed out of reverence to God, they themselves were rewarded with children. God still rewards those who put him first." That's a good lesson from this story here in chapter 1. Put God first, not the government or the king. Verse 22. So Pharaoh, he sees he didn't have any luck with the Hebrew midwives in his command. Pharaoh commanded all his people, the Egyptians, saying, "Every son who is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter, you shall save alive." So what he does here is he makes his own people, the Egyptians, police his decree. The Egyptian midwives wouldn't obey. Now he's telling the people out on the street, "You find a Hebrew male child, throw him into the river, but save the girls alive." So that now he's expecting all of his people to take care of the male children. Now there's a reason why the babies would be thrown into the Nile River. Adam Clark explains, "As the Nile, which is here intended, the river to be thrown the babies into, was a sacred river among the Egyptians, it is not unlikely that Pharaoh intended the young Hebrews as an offering to his God." So he told his people, pitch the male Hebrew children into the Nile River, who they worshipped as a god. Thus, an offering to the god in appeasing the god. It's all that pagan warped system, but it gives us a sense of how warped they really were. Now that brings us to chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse number 1. "And a man of the house of Levi went and took as wife, a daughter of Levi." Okay, sometimes the question will come up, well, if Levi died many years ago, because remember there's a 300-year gap, why is it saying a daughter of Levi? daughter would better be translated here a descendant of Levi. Now we're coming to the story of Moses and his birth. Verse number 2. So the woman conceived and bore a son. Of course, we're talking about Moses here. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. And why? That was because of Pharaoh's decree. She hid Moses for 3 months. Now notice here in verse number 2, the phrase bore a son. And I've already given you the date of 1526 as the date that Moses was born, according to the chronology. Here's an interesting quote from the Companion Bible. Moses was the seventh from Abraham. Abraham was the seventh from Eber. And Enoch, the seventh from Adam. And seven is a number of completeness. Just an interesting sidelight. Notice also that Moses' mother hid him for 3 months. Again, the Companion Bible. This was done by faith, according to Hebrews 11:23, and I'll have that on the screen for you in a moment. Therefore, she must have heard from God. All the steps she took in verses 2 through 4 were the result of believing what she heard from God. You know, at first glance, when you see this in verse number 2, that she hid him for 3 months, it could look like it was fear on the part of Moses' mother. Actually, it was faith that God was in control of everything. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 explains, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. That's what it says. God was in control of this situation and most likely in communication with the parents. And that's what Hebrews 11:23 is explaining. They were not afraid of the king's command. They were doing this by faith in what God had told them to do. Verse number 3. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. Verse 4, and his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Now, I want to stop for a moment, and I've got these a couple of words here in bold letters. I don't know if you can make it out in verse number 3, but I've got ark in bold letters, and also pitch in bold letters. There's a saving process here in the life of Moses. We can compare the salvation of Moses with the salvation of Noah back in Genesis. First of all, the word pitch is the same word that's used on Noah's ark from Genesis 6, verse 14. Remember, they had to put asphalt and pitch all around the ark to keep out the floodwaters of the 40 days and 40 nights, thus saving Noah and his family and all the animals, etc. Also, the word ark here in verse number 3 is the same Hebrew word used for Noah's ark in Genesis chapter 6, which again saved Noah, his family, and all the animal kinds. So we can draw a comparison here between Noah's saving and Moses' saving here from verse number 3. Noah and his family was saved from the judgment waters. Moses was saved from the judgment of Pharaoh and his decree. Verse number 5. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. There was a reason why she did this. This was a religious ceremony. Remember, the Nile River was one of their gods. And her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Okay, the Nelson Study Bible brings out an interesting comment here about verse number 5. Bathing in the Nile was a ritual of dipping in the waters the Egyptians believed to be sacred. And remember, I think I mentioned this previously in the Genesis Bible study series, that the Nile River It was a huge, huge river, longest river in the world, very powerful. There was also crocodiles in the Nile River. But what the Egyptians did is they fenced off a portion and had the Nile River water come into that fenced-off portion. That's where they would go to do this ritual dipping in the waters, this sacred ceremony to worship their god, God with a small g. But notice in verse number 6, she says, this is one of the Hebrews' children. This actually goes together. She's at the river, believing that she's worshiping the Nile god by dipping her feet in the river. Then all of a sudden, here appears this child. She's thinking, I'm receiving a gift from the Nile god. That's why Moses is going to be spared. Okay, she notices, though, in verse number 6, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Pharaoh said to kill them, didn't he? The male babies. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says, most likely he was recognized to be one of that race by the mark of circumcision. So that's how she knew that it was a Hebrew child. The Egyptians didn't circumcise their male children, but the Hebrews did. Okay. Verse number 7. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. Okay, now God is behind all of this that's taking place. Moses is going to be saved. He's going to be the leader of the children of Israel. Pharaoh had decreed that all the male children were to die. Here's the daughter of Pharaoh that saves one of the male children. She's actually going against Pharaoh's decree, isn't she? How is she going to explain to Pharaoh, okay, I've saved this male child and I want him to live? Her explanation is going to be, this isn't in the scriptures, the Nile god gave me this gift. I have this gift from the Nile god. She explained that to him and it was accepted. That's how pagan they were, but that's how he was able to be saved. Okay, let's get back to this now about Pharaoh's daughter saying in verse number 9 to take the child away and nurse him for me. Bible Knowledge Commentary. God's providence is clearly evident in the care of the infant, for miraculously the child was restored to his own parents. So they took Moses and delivered her back to the birth mother. In a vivid display of God's control over the events, Moses' mother was reunited with her child, which was legally sanctioned in the home despite Pharaoh's edict. And she was paid for her services. So if you see that in verse number 9, I will give you your wages, Pharaoh's daughter said. Moses brought back to his birth mother, and she's going to get paid for it, despite Pharaoh's decree. Again, God is behind all of this. Verse number 10, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, Moses' mother did, and he became her son, the son of Pharaoh's daughter. In other words, he became a member of the royal household. So she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. Again, God is behind all of these events. Now, Moses is going to get 40 years opportunity to live at the court of Pharaoh. He's going to get trained at the court of Pharaoh. And this is brought out in the movie The Ten Commandments as well. Pharaoh's daughter here, Bible Knowledge Commentary says, if the monarch at this time was Thutmose I, she may have been his daughter, Hatshepsut. Now, this is a very famous queen of Egypt, and actually she did rule behind the throne, so to speak, for many years. Here's another quote from Merrill. He says, the general picture of Hatshepsut leads us to identify this bold queen as the daughter of Pharaoh who rescued Moses. And this Moses name actually means drawn out. She said, I drew him out of the water. And again, Pharaoh's daughter may have viewed him as the gift of the gods from the Nile god, and therefore wanted to keep him even though he was a Hebrew. And again, it worked. And he actually grew up in Pharaoh's court. Now we come to verse number 10. We've gone through verse number 10. I want to back up again and do some explanation. We see in verse number 10, Moses and the child grew. Again, connecting events with the and. And she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she called his name Moses. Again, let's see here. What am I doing? Okay. Moses was born in 1526. I gave you that date. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen made this comment. He said, "But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds." See, what Stephen is bringing out here in Acts chapter 7 isn't explained in the book of Exodus. But it is kind of brought out in the movie The Ten Commandments, showing how powerful and what a position that Moses, who was played by Charlton Heston, had in the court of Pharaoh. And he was brought up in the Egyptian wisdom and mighty in words and deeds. He was actually Josephus actually stated that Moses became an Egyptian general. 1526 was when he was born. Now we come to verse number 11. There's that word now, which again can be translated and, connecting events together. This is 1486. There's a 40-year gap in between verses 10 and 11. And how do we know that? Well, again, Stephen in Acts chapter 7 explains. Acts chapter 7, verse 23. He says, "Now when he was 40 years old," talking about Moses, "it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." So, what it says here in verse number 11, "It came to pass in those days," Stephen says he's 40 years old by this time. So he's growing up in the court of Pharaoh. Verse number 11, when he's 40 years old, he's going out to visit his brethren to see what's going on. And it says, "It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren, looked at their burdens, and saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren." All right, I've got this up here on the screen here for you. 40-year gap in between verses 10 and 11. Here's the year 1500 in between time here. Again, according to Merrill, this is Thutmose II is reigning here for about 8 years, from 1512 to 1508. He marries his half-sister Hatshepsut, and he dies young under mysterious circumstances. Then the ruler that ruled the most time, Thutmose III, becomes pharaoh as a child with Hatshepsut, his half-sister, as co-regent for his first 20 years. This is the one that Moses is not going to get along with. And we come to verse number 11. He sees one of his Hebrew brethren being beaten, and he's going to take action. But again, Stephen explains that there's 40 years by the time that he grows up in Pharaoh's court and goes out and looks at his brethren and one of them being beaten by an Egyptian. Verse number 11. "Now," or again, "and," connecting events together. "It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown," he's 40 years old now, "that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way, and he looked that way. And when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand." Now let's do some explaining here of what was actually happening with Moses. First of all, we see in verse number 12 that he looks this way and he looks the other way and he saw no one. What that is referring to, the Companion Bible shows us, he saw no one to help. There was no one else that was going to help his fellow Israelite that was being beaten. Here's a companion scripture in Isaiah 59, verse 16. He saw there was no man and wondered that there was no intercessor. And actually was no legal procedure to stop the Egyptian from beating the Hebrew. Verse 13, And when he went out on the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? Now there's three words here that have got in bold letters in these verses. This one here, beating, and again this is our English word. Then we have in verse number 12, killed, and in verse number 13, striking. Actually, from the Hebrew, they all come from one Hebrew stem and can be translated very similar. If you're reading in the Old King James, in verse 11 where it says beating, it says smiting in the Old King James. And in verse number 12 where it says killed, in the Old King James, it slew. And down here in verse 13, in the New King James, it says striking. In the Old King James, it says smitest your companion or your fellow. Okay, so in verses 11, we see beating, verse 12, killed, and in verse 13, striking. Word commentary brings out this very important point. It says, in each case, the verb is the hyphal stem, which is best translated by the same English verb. Now here's what's important. The sense in each instance is probably a series of blows rather than a single death-dealing blow. The point is that there is in the text no suggestion that Moses meant to kill the Egyptian. So, again, that's a lot of words, but from the Hebrew, this is all the same word. And what it was just, they were duking it out, a series of blows between the Egyptian and Moses. And within these blows, the Egyptian died. So, there wasn't any apparent intention on Moses' part to kill this Egyptian. It was just during the fight it happened. He was killed. And he hit him in the dirt or in the sand. Okay, then the fellow Israelites, they had saw what had happened. Moses was unaware of this. And in verse 14, one of the Israelites said to Moses, who made you a prince and judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Now, I've already pointed out that he didn't intend to kill the Egyptian, but his fellow Israelites were branding him that way, that he intended to kill the Egyptian. So Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. He didn't think anybody had seen what had happened when he was fighting with this Egyptian. But what this amounts to is killing an Egyptian by an Israelite would mean capital punishment. That's why he's going to have to flee to Midian. Okay, Stephen explains this now in Acts chapter 7. Now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. Verse 25. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. So he thought by protecting his fellow Israelite that he would naturally be the deliverer. But God has to work with him further and mold and shape him, and he's going to have to go out into the desert for another 40 years. Now we come to verse number 15. When Pharaoh, and this is Thutmose III now, the one that had been in competition with Moses, we'll call him Yul Brynner from the Ten Commandments movie. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, and he's reigning for 54 years now, he sought to kill Moses. Capital punishment. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. This is in the year 1486 when Moses has to flee. He's 40 years old now, and he's going to be out of Egypt for another 40 years. Here's a comment from Merrill. He says this, Thutmose III was a minor when he came to power in 1504, and thus was younger than Moses. If indeed Moses had been reared as the foster son of Hatshepsut, there's every likelihood that he posed a real threat to the younger Thutmose, since Hatshepsut had no natural sons. That is, Moses may have been a candidate for Pharaoh, only his Semitic origins standing in the way. So what this is saying is, remember, he'd been brought up by Pharaoh's daughter. He was a candidate, Moses was, to become Pharaoh himself. Now Thutmose III has a good way to get rid of him. He slew another Egyptian. Moses has to flee. Continuing on, Merrill says, there appears in any case to have been a genuine animosity between Moses and Pharaoh. This is evident in the fact that Moses, having slain the Egyptian, was forced to flee for his life. And he had to do that because he was capital punishment, and Pharaoh had him, and Moses had to flee. Let's talk a few moments now about Thutmose III, this particular Pharaoh. This is from Archaeology in the Old Testament, Merrill Unger. He says, the picture of Thutmose III as the great oppressor of the Israelites is quite credible. He was the great builder and employed Semitic slaves in his vast construction projects. 54 years, he's ruling. Continuing on, he says, the death of Hatshepsut, that's Moses, the daughter of Pharaoh who brought Moses up, the death of Hatshepsut and the ascension of Thutmose III doubtless inaugurated the last and most severe phase of the oppression of Israel. So Pharaoh's daughter no longer living, the one that saved Moses. Now Thutmose III is in absolute control, and he really puts the screws to the Egyptians and makes their lives even more miserable. One more point from Unger. He says, the new monarch was one of the greatest foreign conquerors in Egyptian history. In numerous victorious campaigns in Syria, Palestine, he pushed the frontiers of Egypt to the Euphrates River. This is brought out very good in the Ten Commandments movie, where the scene is with Yul Brynner, and there's all these people coming from all these other lands, and they're spreading out all their gifts on the floor that they had brought because he had conquered all these other nations. He was a great conqueror. Verse number 15. The last part. Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. He's 40 years old now when he has to flee from Egypt, and he flees to Midian. And he sojourns there 40 years in the land of Midian. That's brought out in Acts chapter 7, verse 30. In other words, two-thirds of Moses' life is covered in Exodus chapter 2. Remember I showed that he lived 120 years? He lived 40 years in the court of Pharaoh. Then he flees to Midian for 40 years. Two-thirds of his life is all capitalized in Exodus chapter 2. Now we talk about what happens while he's in Midian in verse 16. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And that's brought out in the movie as well, where the daughters were getting water and these other shepherds come along and drive the other animals away. And then Moses kind of steps in. He's got his staff with him, and he fights off these other shepherds. Now Midianites, here that are described, were descended from Abraham and Keturah, from Genesis chapter 25, verses 1 through 4. So, distant relatives of the Israelites and Moses as well. Sometimes people ask, why was this man in verse 16 described as a priest of Midian? We're going to find out his name is Reuel in verse 18. And he's also known as Jethro, and he's the father-in-law of Moses. And the reason why he's described as a priest is because, being the head of a family, he would have offered sacrifices according to the Levitical system. So, as a head of a family, you had to offer sacrifices. Thus, you're labeled as a priest. And that's why he's called this in verse 16. Verse number 18. Now when they came to Reuel, their father, who's this described as a priest of Midian, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian," talking about Moses, "delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock." So she said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that they may eat, that he may eat bread." Remember back in those ancient times, the best thing that you could do, you know, was invite somebody to have a meal with you, to share bread. That was a social event of those times. The Nelson Study Bible. Reuel's invitation to eat bread was more than a casual bite to eat. He was recruiting Moses to marry one of his seven daughters. So he had another motive behind this, besides just socially interacting. He's got seven daughters. One of them he wants to give to Moses as wife. Verse 21. Then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And she bore him a son. He called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." Gershom means a stranger there. This is the Nelson Study Bible. Moses was doubly removed from his land. He and his people, the Israelites, were strangers in Egypt. Now he was cast off from them and estranged yet in another waiting place. So, strangers in the land of Egypt, now he's a stranger in the land of Midian for 40 years. Now we're coming to the end here of chapter 2, verse number 23. Now it happened, connecting these events together, in the process of time, that the king of Egypt died. And this is Thutmose III. This is approximately the year 1450 when he died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of their bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. Now, when you put together what I explained in the first Bible study, all those years that they were in slavery, and you look at verse number 23, and you can really get the sense of all of this. Merrill says, "For 40 years, Moses remained a fugitive from Egypt. One of the reasons for such a long exile was the fact that Pharaoh, from whom Moses had fled, continued to live and reign during that time. It was only after his death that Moses felt free to return to Egypt." Moses could not go back as long as Thutmose III lived. Nelson Study Bible points out another interesting point about this. At the death of a pharaoh, Egyptian authorities dropped all pending charges, even capital cases. So, at the end, when a pharaoh died, a capital punishment, like what would happen to Moses, was dropped completely. Now he's free to return back to Egypt. No longer would be under the death penalty because a pharaoh died and all pending charges were dropped. Verse 24. So God heard their groaning after all these years and years of bondage. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. And that brings us to the end of chapter 2. And now we're going to find a new Pharaoh would come to power in Egypt, because definitely the scripture tells us Thutmose III died. This is the one who Moses and Aaron would deal with during the time of the 10 plagues with Egypt. His name is Amenhotep II. And this is the dates that they give for him. Merrill again says this: "The best understanding suggests that Amenhotep's power did not pass to his eldest son, but rather to Thutmose IV, a younger son." So, what this is saying is it's known that after Amenhotep II, his oldest son didn't reign. Why was that? Because he was killed in the 10th plague. So this is even known from Egyptian history and archaeology, that the firstborn of Amenhotep did not rule next. One more quote from Archaeology in the Old Testament by Unger. He says this: the Exodus took place in the reign of Amenhotep II, who evidently was the king who hardened his heart and would not let the children of Israel go. If Amenhotep was the reigning pharaoh of the Exodus, his eldest son was slain in the 10th plague. Because it is plain, Unger says, from the monuments that Thutmose IV, who excavated the Sphinx, was not the eldest son of Amenhotep II. So even from the Egyptian monuments themselves, it's clear that the eldest son of Amenhotep II did not rule next. And that was because of the 10th plague and the male children of Egypt dying. Okay, as I usually do, we'll talk about some lessons from chapter 1 and 2. I've already described a few of them. Israel's slavery and hard bondage is symbolic of our slavery to sin and the bondage it puts on us. We talk about that during the days of unleavened bread. Also, one of the lessons that I don't have on the screen, I talked about the fact that the midwives, the Hebrew midwives, didn't obey Pharaoh's command. They obeyed God first. That's a good lesson for us. Another lesson, God intervenes at the appropriate time when he chooses. For instance, the edict by Pharaoh to kill newborn children. God was behind all of that in the saving process of Moses. Another lesson that I'll leave you with today. Moses had three 40-year segments of training. 40 years under the court of Pharaoh, 40 years in the land of Midian, and 40 years working with Pharaoh during the plagues and leading the children of Israel out of Egypt. Just as God prepared Moses, he prepared his people, he prepares his people today. We go through our training process in very various ways. Sometimes we have hard knocks throughout the years. We make mistakes, as Moses did. There are things that happen in our lives, but God is working with us in training so that we can be of service to him in the future, just as Moses was. That brings us to the end of our study today. Any questions or comments from either of the studies? No. What I was referring to was Moses' three 40-year segments of his training. And so he was 40 years in the court of Pharaoh. Then he lives for 40 years in Midian, where he married his wife and had a child. Then he comes back. And those last 40 years was another training period for him, where he deals with Pharaoh, with the plagues, leads the children of Israel out of Egypt. They cross through the Red Sea. Then he comes down from the mount and they've built the golden calf. All that was another 40 years of his training as well. And again, various processes, as we go through processes as well. Does that help? So yeah, the plagues were not 40 years. It was probably, as I explained earlier, a 9-month process on the calendar year. 9 months of duration. But then Moses is going on for another 39 years of his life with the children of Israel. I thought I saw another hand come up. Yes, Bill.
Was not the Israelites a different color race of people than the Egyptians?
Yes, the It could have been, but you know, one of the commentaries pointed out that the first thing that she would have noticed was that he was circumcised, which God commanded that all of the Israelites were, all the male children were to be circumcised. So yes, that could have been another point too. This child's circumcised, and looking at him too, that he's Semitic from Shem instead of from Ham. That's just one. You know, there's probably a couple of things, maybe another even thing that we could talk about, that she discovered that he was not an Egyptian. Anything else? Okay, well, I guess I must have covered the basis pretty well. I know it was a lot of material. And again, all of you that have email, internet, I'll send this out and you can ponder over it and study it some more at home in your own time. Very good. We'll see you next time.